Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Early Colonial Craft, the first 25 years, with Mr. Vaughan Evans. It's an in-depth study of the vessels built in the colony between 1788 and 1811, and he has unearthed some unusual facts.
Well, thank you very much, and good evening once again, ladies and gentlemen. Now, the talk is, as you heard, early colonial craft in the first 25 years of the colony. Now, some of us wrote Lionel Hale in a newspaper article many years ago, some of us are born like Robinson Crusoe, who could build a hut and plant a garden and breed goats, using one rusty nail, a handful of wet corn and a piece of string. And some of us, he added, are not. Now you may wonder what on earth that quotation has got to do with the early colonial craft of New South Wales. But I reckon it's pretty appropriate. Because really, when you come to think of it, were not these men on the first, second and third fleets, were they not cast ashore on a deserted, if not a desert land, to fend for themselves and build what they could, and let's face it, with hardly more than a nail, a handful of wet corn and a piece of string apiece. Now, when the first fleet arrived, they had no real accommodation at all. They had a temporary hut for the governor. They had tents. And as winter approached, they needed something more substantial. And the very first account we have in the official records and dispatches of a colonial craft of any sort is that the longboats of the ships in the cove were employed in bringing up cabbage tree from the lower part of the harbour, where it grew in great abundance, and was found very fit for the purpose of erecting temporary huts. Now you'll notice they used longboats of the ships in the cove, and the reason was that they had nothing else, except perhaps for a few boats brought out privately by officers for their own use. Admittedly, Governor Phillip had two boats which had been brought out in frame, that is, knocked down, ready to be erected when possible. And many ships in those days carried boats in frames sewed away in their holds in case their own craft should be lost. La Perouse had two, which he put together in Botany Bay in February 1788. So really, you should say the credit for the first shipbuilding or boat building goes to La Perouse. In the case of Phillips' boats, it was not until September 1788 that the carpenter of the Supply could be spared to do the work of putting these two boats together, a 16-oared boat and an 8-oared boat. Most of his fellow carpenters were busy building huts when they could be spared from their ships. It seems odd to us today that when the settlement was first made, they did not bother about transport of any sort, animals or things like even wheelbarrows. They thought that, you know, they were here, they could fend for themselves. Now, during this first year of settlement, 1788, the search for better land for the cultivation of crops led to the choice of Rose Hill, or Parramatta as we now know it, where settlement began in November that first year. Now, think of Parramatta. Access by land was tedious, to say the least, in a settlement which had no draft animals. And even if you were lucky enough to have built yourself a wheelbarrow, it was a long 15 miles to walk from here to Parramatta on a dirt road in and out of the tree stumps. It'd be a hard job for me to push a wheelbarrow 15 miles along Parramatta Road today, but still. Anyhow, it was decided that they had to construct a launch or a hoy capable of being employed in carrying provisions to Rose Hill and for other useful purposes. Collins tells us that work on this hoy commenced in May 1789, just over a year after the first settlement. She was designed to carry 10 tons, and that's all we know. probably means that if she was a hoy, she was no more than about 30 feet long, and she was put into the water in October, 5 months later. Collins tells us, from the quantity of wood used in her construction, she appeared to be a mere bed of timber, and when launched, was named by the convicts with an happiness that is sometimes visible in the lower order of people, by the name of the Lump. By the name of the Rose Hill Packet. She was afterwards generally known by the name the Lump, a word more strictly applied to her size and construction, and was very soon employed in transporting provisions to Rose Hill. And going up with the tide at the flood, at the top of high water, she passed very well over the flats at the upper part of the harbour. But what Collins doesn't tell us is that she sometimes took a week for the round trip, and that also he doesn't tell us that this much maligned vessel was originally given the magnificent name Prince of Wales, for this is what she is apparently was christened at her launch, according to James Scott, a sergeant of marines who wrote a diary. Nobody ever called her the Prince of Wales, and frankly I've been longing to get a picture of the Prince of Wales at that time to see if he was the Lump too. Was Prinny the Lump in 1788? I think he may have been. Anyhow, it's impossible to give a description of this, the first vessel of any size to be built in the colony. There is no positively identifiable picture of her. She was far too lowly for her portrait to be painted. And if you read the good books of the day, a definition of a hoy doesn't help much either. Listen to this. It is very difficult to describe precisely the marks of distinction between this vessel and some others of the same size, which are also rigged in the same manner, because what is called a hoy in one place would assume the name of a sloop or a smack in another. It has but one mast, where the mainsail is sometimes extended by a boom and sometimes without it. Now, if that's all we can learn from Falconer's celebrated Marine Dictionary of 1780, who are we a mere 200 years later to say precisely what or was not a hoy and just what the Rose Hill Packet looked like? Now, Governor Phillip had great difficulty in completing even this little vessel. He had to rely on the ship's carpenters, the Sirius and the Supply, when they could be spared, with the assistance of such convicts as were capable of acting under their direction. Now, even before she was built, Phillip wrote to England of the need for a strong launch to carry provisions to the new settlement at Rose Hill, and added, the settlement on Norfolk Island and the extent of the harbour would render two vessels of 30 or 40 tons of infinite service. In the meantime, he borrowed two of the boats of the Sirius, which she could ill spare, while the Sirius went off to Table Bay for provisions. Now, this voyage of the Sirius was desperately important to the settlement, for the threat of starvation was very real in those early years, and it's not surprising that attempts were made to augment the rations with fish caught in the harbour. And it's accounts of this fishing that enable us to know that they were small craft even in the first two or three years. By April 1790, food was so scarce that all private boats were ordered to be surrendered to the public use in fishing for the general benefit. The largest fish seen in the harbour, incidentally, was a sperm whale. We may guess that private boat building had boomed in this period, for in April 1791 an order was made limiting the length of such boats as should be built by individuals to 14 feet from stem to stern, that the size of such boats might deter the convicts from attempts to take them off. And what is pathetic about this business of convicts taking off the boats of the settlement is that they thought that China lay the other side of the Hawkesbury. And there are accounts of poor convicts being rescued from the bush this side of the Hawkesbury, who literally thought they had one more hill to go. Now, it's not quite so silly as it sounds, because I came out to Australia only 21 years ago in a migrant ship, and on board that ship were people who had seen their school atlases, and England couldn't fit one page. You know, you had England and Scotland had to go on a separate page and Ireland on another one. Australia fitted onto one page, and I knew a family from the Five Towns, Burslem and all the rest of it, who those five towns are within tram ride of each other. And these two families, one was going to Melbourne and one was going to Sydney, and they'd looked at the map and they knew they'd go by tram between Melbourne and Sydney every weekend. So I don't think convicts 150, 200 years ago should be blamed for thinking that China lay just beyond the Hawkesbury. In the meantime, where are we? We'd better get back. Anyhow, it's February 1792, 4 years after the first fleet arrived, that Governor Phillip, at long last, received help from England in the shape of a sloop of 41 tons burthen, sent out in frame by the Pitt Transport to be erected here. But the problem was where to find shipwrights. It was felt that the colony's needs would have been better served had the sloop been put together, coppered, and sent out fully manned from England. But England too, if you think of it, had enough troubles of her own at the end of the 18th century. There was only one shipwright in the whole colony who was free to put the vessel together. He offered to put the little sloop together and was engaged at the princely sum, wait for it, of 2 shillings a day and his provisions. He laid the keel on blocks near where the custom house stands on Circular Quay. Governor Phillip didn't stay long enough to see this vessel finished. He returned to England in December 1792, leaving Lieutenant Governor Grose in charge. But the vessel was launched the following July on the birthday of Lieutenant Governor Grose's son, whose the birthday of this boy. His name was Francis. And I think it's a lovely thought, but a beautiful birthday present for young Francis Grose, that this ship was named the Francis. He must have been the proudest small boy in the whole of the colony. The Francis was launched, and she was rigged as a schooner because they thought this was a safer rig than that of the sloop with its one mast and its heavier gear. Unfortunately, the local experts soon realised they had spoiled her sailing qualities by doing so, but it was as a schooner that this first colonial vessel continued all her life. She was sent off as soon as she'd been fitted out to Dusky Bay, South Island, New Zealand, with the Britannia, a southern whaler which also served as a transport, to see if the Dusky Bay area was suitable for settlement. Now, it's an interesting little sidelight on the ships of this colony that the Britannia had called at Dusky Bay about a year before and had left a party of men to collect sealskins, and had also left the ship's carpenter, who was to construct a small vessel in case the Britannia couldn't get back. The vessel was to be of 65 tons burthen and was almost ready to launch when the men were picked up. The nearly completed hull was left on shore. And the interesting point to us is the shipwright concerned was a certain Mr. Moore, who later became the government's master shipwright, a highly respected member of the colony, even if he married a convict wife, and who is remembered today mainly by the Theological College, which bears his name, and which he endowed, and by the suburb, which also bears his name. Now, when the Francis and the Britannia were away at Dusky Bay, the shipwrights in Sydney had put together the frame of a longboat bought from the master of the Britannia. They had repaired the Rose Hill packet too, for after only 4 years' service, she had been completely put out of commission by the depredations of the Teredo shipworms, as Collins tells us, which infested the harbour then and undoubtedly still do today. At this time, Collins tells us, the boat builders and shipwrights found occupation enough for their leisure hours in building boats for those who could afford to pay for them. 5 and 6 gallons of spirits was the price, and 5 or 6 days would complete a boat fit to go up the harbour. But many of them were very badly put together, he continued, and threatened destruction to whoever might unfortunately be caught in them with a sail up in blowing weather. Frankly, ladies and gentlemen, if 5 or 6 gallons of spirits was the going price, I'm surprised they finished one of these beastly little boats. I think he was a bit unkind too, Collins, on these local boat bills. You know, the carpenter was a supplier of the Britannia. He was a proper ship's carpenter, and he was put ashore with his full toolkit. He was put ashore with all the ironwork he needed. In other words, all he had to do was to cut the timber and shape it and put it together. But I mean, all the bits and pieces apart from the timber, he had. These men in Sydney were working with much inferior timber, and they had to scrounge everything else that they could lay their hands on in a colony where everything was scarce. We know that the timber around Port Jackson was generally most unsatisfactory, and that the Norfolk Island pine, of which so much hope had been held, was found to be unfit for large masts or spars, shaky or rotten at 30 or 40 feet from the butt, too brittle for oars, and too porous for the planks of a boat. The days of seemingly endless supplies of cedar lay some years in the future. But you know, not all of the boats could have been bad. for in December 1793 we find that among the conveniences that were now enjoyed in the colony was the introduction of passage boats, which were allowed to go between Sydney and Parramatta. They were the property of persons who had served their respective terms of transportation, and from each passenger 1 shilling was required for his passage. Baggage was paid for at the rate of 1 shilling per hundredweight, and the entire boat could be hired by one person for 6 shillings. We are told that the proprietors found these rates very profitable. It's not really surprising when you realise that Parramatta, first settled in November 1788, had outstripped Sydney by the year 1792 with a population of nearly 2,000 as against Sydney's 1,000, and although the relative size of Parramatta declined from then on, the actual number of settlers increased from year to year. On the subject of these passage boats, it's interesting to read in the official orders that they were permitted to carry oars so that customers might help the crew if they cared to do so. Ladies and gentlemen, if I had a great big ex-convict, I think I'd be going all the way. Anyhow, by 1794, the number of private boats in the colony was said to be considerable, only 6 years after settlement. In addition to the passage boats, the fishing boats and the pleasure craft, there was also a little fleet by now of boats called lumpsters, which brought garden produce from the eastern farms, later known as Kissing Point, still later known as Ryde, and firewood from Lane Cove. There's an interesting point, I have to keep my finger on the page, otherwise I don't know where I'm at. An interesting point, only 2 weeks ago I went on a little bushwalk in the Lane Cove area, the bottom of Mowbray Road, and believe it or not, you can still see the chimney of the huts used by men in the Lane Cove area for timber getting and for collecting the rushes that they had for fodder and bedding for the animals and so forth. The old chimneys are still there, and these do date from the 1780-90 period. In this year, 1794 also, the need arose for rather more sturdy boats that could go from Sydney to the Hawkesbury, for the Lieutenant Governor, Gross, had put 22 settlers into the region then known as Green Hills and now known as Windsor. Now, in between trips to Norfolk Island, the colonial schooner Francis was employed in supplying these new settlers, and in fact, she spent 5 months from September 1794 almost continuously at this work, on one occasion bringing back 1,000 bushels of corn, while in 1795 she could only be spared once for Norfolk Island. Now, she was the only colonial craft available to the government. Norfolk Island had to rely on the chance visit of the Fancy, a Snow, on 2 visits later in the year, and by the newly arrived HMS Supply, that's the second HMS Supply, and 1 visit by HMS Reliance when she brought out Governor Hunter. These were chance visits. Norfolk Island had no official visit from Sydney. Now, up to Hunter's time, there's no evidence of official ship or boat building in the colony apart from the Rosehill Packet, the Francis, and the 16 and 8 oar boats put together in 1788, and the longboat put together in 1793. Not a very impressive colonial navy at that time. On the other hand, only 7 months after his arrival, Hunter expressed concern at the number of people who were building boats privately for anyone who would employ them, a liberty, he said, which has crept into the settlement in opposition to all former orders. In future, official permission in writing had to be obtained before building any boat, while all existing boats in private hands were to have an official number cut into their sterns or to be liable for seizure. Later on in that same year of 1796, he expressed concern at the state of the Francis and said that if he had sufficient carpenters, he would undertake to build a larger vessel to replace her for service between Sydney and Norfolk Island. A vessel that would have served this purpose very well had arrived in Sydney soon after he himself had arrived, perhaps before Hunter was fully aware of the need, because in January 1796, the schooner Providence arrived from Dusky Bay. Now, this was the vessel built by the carpenter of the Britannia in 1793 and now completed by men from the Endeavour, a very old and very highly insured East Indiaman that scuttled there, not perhaps entirely by chance, knowing there was a ship to take them away again. The little schooner was highly regarded in Sydney, but she belonged to an officer of the East India Company, and she sailed for China, and it was really a great loss to this settlement. A few months later, 2 months later, another smaller vessel arrived, built by the shipwright of the Endeavour, to carry the remainder of the crew back from Dusky Bay. She was named the Assistance, but unlike the Providence, she was miserably constructed, according to Collins. But nevertheless, she sold for £250, which was a small fortune, and she went off to the sealing grounds and is heard of no more. Now, conditions in the settlement were gradually improving 8 years after the beginning, and timber suitable for boat building was beginning to be brought from the Hawkesbury. But other naval stores were still very scarce indeed. Collins tells us, "In May 1797, the settlement was so much distressed for canvas that the largest and best boat being in the Hawkesbury, it became necessary to dismantle another boat in order to furnish sails to bring her round, those belonging to her having been split in some bad weather. The people, at the same time, were to procure some of the bark of a tree lately discovered to be manufactured into cordage, for the want of cordage was also very acute. For this purpose it was reckoned superior to any of the flax that had been brought from Norfolk Island." Now, this intrigued me to think of our forebears making rope from the bark of a tree. And of course, they were only copying the local aboriginals, because they made string, nets, all sorts of things from the same tree. And it was the black or forest kurrajong. I'm not very good on my trees, but I've got a slide for those of you who can like to say, no, that's not a black or forest kurrajong, but anyhow, I'll give you a picture of one that I think is the right tree. Unfortunately, this largest and best boat belonging to the settlement, called the Cumberland, was seized by convicts on her way to the Hawkesbury in September and was wrecked by them. Now, the only good that came of this was that Lieutenant John Shortland, who set out after the convicts in an armed whaleboat, confirmed the location of Hunter's River and the existence of coal deposits there on his way back, although credit for the actual discovery goes to a party of fishermen who chanced upon the Hunter's River a year before. Now, the seizure of boats by convicts attempting to escape was a continuing problem, and following the escape of a party of them in a small boat stolen at Parramatta, a boat which incidentally they took as far as Wilson's Promontory in Bass Strait before coming to grief, Hunter took action again. He expressed concern at the number of private boats, at their carrying on forbidden traffic, at the manner of their being laid up, and in an order dated October 1797 he forbade any further private boat building whatsoever. He also arranged for a trusty person to inspect boats laid up at night ashore or secured afloat, and to see that all oars, masts, sails and rudders were properly secured in the dwelling of the owner. The penalty for non-compliance was severe. The boat was immediately scuttled, if afloat, or burnt, if ashore. In the same order, Hunter forbade boats to leave for the Hawkesbury or Botany Bay without a pass. But even these orders weren't successful, for within 3 months, convicts seized yet another boat and made their escape towards China. Now, private boat building presumably had slowed down at least following Hunter's order, but official boat building began in earnest in 1797. In one of the official returns for labour, you can find that work had commenced on the establishment of a dockyard, which, as you know, was built roughly the site of the Maritime Services Board. And the following new boats were being built: a new pinnace, a whaleboat for Parramatta, a burthensome punt for discharging ships, a boat for HMS Reliance, a longboat for HMS Supply, and a new wood boat for the hospital. In addition, the Francis had been repaired, as had the hospital and South Head boats, while the keel of a new brig of 150 tons burthen had been laid. We know also that a small schooner named the Sydney was now in service with a master and 5 men to carry provisions to the Hawkesbury and to bring grain, cedar and other produce back. Now, the Sydney is described as a schooner, but she was in effect no more than a decked longboat, perhaps the one bought in frame from the Britannia in 1793, and nothing else is known of her except that she must have been built here. Now, all through this difficult year of 1797, Norfolk Island was sadly neglected. The only ships to call were HMS Reliance in June and the Little Francis in August. The commandant of Norfolk Island, the Captain Townsend, was determined to provide himself with the means of sending his dispatches with greater regularity, and he decided to build what he described as a sloop of 25 tons. She was launched in the year 1798 and named appropriately the Norfolk. She sailed immediately for Sydney, untested, untried, and, as it turned out, very, very leaky. "A man on the island," said Collins, "had sufficient ingenuity to make a quadrant for navigating her." Now, I find that very surprising, but of course we don't know whether this particular quadrant was just three nails in a piece of wood, or if it was like a proper quadrant. But it's pretty clever of a convict on the island to make a quadrant to sail this boat back to Sydney. On her arrival in June 1798, the Norfolk was described merely as a decked longboat. On October the 7th, this decked longboat left for Van Diemen's Land under the command of Lieutenant Matthew Flinders to become the first vessel to navigate that island and to prove without a doubt the existence of Bass Strait. Now, I don't doubt most of you gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen here, appreciate just how small Flinders' boat was. This was the biggest of his boats up to that time, damn it all. Tom Thumb was an 8-footer. But the Norfolk would not have been more than 30 feet. Couldn't have been more than 30 feet to be described as a decked longboat. Poor Captain Townsend, anyway, he got very little benefit from his enterprise in building the Norfolk. She made only one round voyage to the Norfolk Island in April 1799, and then she was employed exclusively on the New South Wales coast, mainly to the Hawkesbury and back, was seized by convicts in October 1800, and was completely wrecked. Poor Norfolk again, because the brig commenced by Governor Hunter in 1797 for the island was not to be finished for 18 and a half years, and when she was finished, the settlement on Norfolk Island had long since been abandoned. Meantime, in Sydney in this year, 1798, work continued apace at the government dockyard, despite the fact, as Collins tells us, that the colony was at this time in such want of naval stores of every kind that the ruin of all the floating craft so lately in good condition was nearly effected. The bottoms of the boats were destroyed by the worms for want of pitch, tar, paint and oil. And in order to enable the colonial schooner Francis to proceed to Norfolk Island, it had been necessary to reduce part of HMS Supplies sails and convert them to her use. We know that in 1798, despite these shortages, there were 21 men employed by the government as shipwrights, caulkers, boat builders, labourers and watchmen in the dockyard. And a statement of their work is really very impressive. They began building a boat of 28 tons to replace the Cumberland lost the year before. They repaired the Sydney schooner and all the government boats. They repaired the Norfolk sloop and made new oars, pumps, masts and spars for her. They did considerable work on HMS Reliance. In addition, there were carpenters, blacksmiths and bricklayers at work improving the dockyard itself, and rope makers twisting cordage out of the bark of the Kurrajong. The year 1798 is important for private enterprise too, for in this year the keel of a vessel was laid in Underwood's yard. She was the first private vessel of any reasonable size in the colony for which permission to build had been granted. Hunter had agreed on the understanding the new vessel would be able to reduce the cost of carrying grain from the Hawkesbury by 33 1/3%, from 15 pence to 10 pence per bushel. But such was the shortage of labour and such were the differences between the syndicate of owners that the work was abandoned for 4 years after the frame had been erected. Incidentally, the frame was of hardwood. Just imagine the job they'd had when they started work again 4 years later. She was to be 38 feet long on the keel and of 44 tons measurement. No Leviathan, but the largest vessel by far to be privately built up to that time. In 1799, work in the dockyard continued much as in the previous year. The Cumberland was still on the stocks, and mention is made of work on HMS Buffalo, recently arrived in April that year, and which was to take Hunter back to England in the following year. In fact, there was always a tremendous amount of work to be done on ships of the Royal Navy. By the time they got here, they really were falling apart, if you read the records aright. Anyhow, Collins gives us an amusing piece of information about the Buffalo. He says, "Although this ship was named the Buffalo, yet her figurehead was the carved figure of a kangaroo, which very much amused the natives, and presumably the settlers and the convicts too." Anyhow, that was a new ship, the Buffalo, with a kangaroo figurehead. 1799 also, there's mention of another private vessel built here. She was the Martha, variously described as a schooner or a snow. of 30 tons built for Boston & Co. and employed in the sealing trade. It's interesting to note that because of his instructions, the governor could not give a boat such as the Martha a certificate of registry, but he gave her instead a certificate permitting her to make voyages on the coast of New South Wales. Now, the governor's jurisdiction extended to islands lying off the coast, and this came to be interpreted rather liberally, I think you'll agree, as allowing voyages to such islands lying off the coast as Tahiti, a matter of a mere 300 miles as the crow flies, and about 3,000 miles as the crow flies, and about 9,000 as the ship sails. Under her master, William Reed, and with a crew of four men, this vessel, the Martha, returned from Bass Straits in December 1799 with a cargo of 30 tierces of seal oil and 1,300 seal skins. Now, this was a small boat, and a master and four men, 1,300 seal skins and 30 tierces of oil. It should be appreciated that by the turn of the century, the large proportion of the 5,000 inhabitants of Sydney no longer had the right to draw on the government stores for their food and other requirements. They had served their term of transportation, and knowing of the wealth to be had from Bass Straits, some of them began to take to the sea in this brutal trade. There was also, of course, a continuing desperate need for water transport of any sort, and it was only natural that many other men should take to the sea in the more humdrum role as carriers, the sealers joining them in the winter months. With the proceeds of their enterprise, these men were increasingly able to finance the construction of more and better craft, and as conditions gradually improved, not only better, but bigger and really much more seaworthy craft. And it's from this period, around the turn of the century, 12 years or so after the first fleet had arrived, that private ship and boat building began to forge ahead. But before we look at what happened, let us see how official colonial craft had fared in the new century. In many ways, it's a discouraging story, but only because the need for government colonial craft, except for surveying and official purposes, was now being taken over very ably by private enterprise. In 1801, the Francis was reported to be very weak and wants great repairs, and all the other smaller craft were described as very old and in need of constant repairs. Two new boats were being built, and the Bee, a sloop of 11 tons, a longboat decked, was in service, a very useful vessel for bringing grain, etc., from the different settlements. Now, I'll just pause here to say, I've mentioned various vessels which were longboats decked. And you can't be very exact in saying, well, a longboat today is such and such a length and such a beam, and this is the tradition size of a longboat. A longboat of 30 tons, a longboat of 25 tons, a longboat of 11 tons. And the measurement in those days was very rule of thumb, length times breadth over 2 times breadth over 94 or something. So it's purely a little formula. And so these longboats could be possibly no more than, say, 24 feet up to 32 feet. They're a fairly small range of size, but the small ones were small. The Bee, a very useful vessel for bringing grain from the settlements. In that year, the Cumberland also was finished, and in 1802, a new colonial vessel was being built, the Integrity, a sloop of 51 tons, which was finished in only 15 months by four carpenters, two of whom had never been, had no previous experience on ships or boats. We are told that all the necessary timber had been converted by one pair of sawyers working for only 20 weeks. You know, when you think of that, a 51-ton vessel, all that timber converted by two men, our forebears knew how to work, or else they were made to work, or both. One interesting addition to the fleet of official colonial vessels in 1803 was the Resource. She was described as a 26-ton schooner built out of the wreck of HMS Porpoise, on which Matthew Flinders had hoped to return to England. She was probably another longboat decked. Flinders chose to take over the Cumberland, the colonial-built craft, for his return to England instead, and his sorry experiences with this vessel and his life as a prisoner of the French on the Isle of Mauritius is another story. It's interesting to note that the Cumberland was not the only one of our colonial craft to end her days at Mauritius at this date. Baudin, the French explorer, bought a small sealing vessel, brand new vessel, in 1803. She was known as the Casuarina, and he employed her on explorations under the command of de Freycinet. She was broken up on her arrival at Mauritius in 1804. Now, she was called the Casuarina because she was built of Casuarina wood, which is a most unsuitable wood for boat building, I'm told. In 1804, King announced the receipt of two plans sent out by the Admiralty for vessels to be built here. One was for what was described as a flat-bottomed boat, nothing more or less than a swim-headed Thames sailing barge, and the other a 53-foot-long schooner of 60 tons. Neither appears to have been built here. And this is really not very surprising, for, as I said before, private vessels had virtually taken over the carrying trade between the various settlements. It's illustrated also by the fact that it was in 1804 that the government actually auctioned off their busy little sloop, the Bee, to private ownership. There is little report from this time on. The official colonial craft had virtually had their day. 8 or 10 of them, and that was all for the first 25 years. They'd had their day when they were really maids of all work in the fetching and carrying trades. Now, to return to private colonial craft, I haven't previously stated tonight, but every governor, since the very first days of settlement, had very strict instructions as follows. Every sort of intercourse with the settlements of the East India Company, as well as the coast of China and the islands situated on that part of the world, to which any intercourse has been established by any European nation, should be prevented by every possible means. And you are not to allow a craft of any sort to be built for the use of private individuals which might enable them to effect such intercourse. Now, because of the severe shortages of skilled labour and of naval stores which I have mentioned, and because of the desperate need of the settlement for transport to keep itself alive, there had been little chance up to the turn of the 19th century that the official orders could be broken. Official concern here had been to survive and to prevent the escape of convicts. Warnings against the infringement of the powerful monopoly of the East India Company could hardly have been considered for many, many years other than as a joke by those beastly Poms in very, very bad taste. Regarding the coasting voyages of our early colonial craft, frankly, we know little for the first 15 years of settlement. For one thing, the boats were small, hardly more than large rowing boats, and the nature of their business was humdrum and only worthy of comment in the surviving records if they should come to grief or get themselves taken by prisoners. There was no shipping register of any sort for the first 13 years. The Hawkesbury was settled from 1794 on, and we know that boats were bringing back cargoes of grain and cedar within a year or so of that date. In fact, we may infer that the trade in cedar grew to be considerable from the fact that in April 1802 a general order was issued strictly forbidding cedar to be cut without official permission, any unauthorised logs or planks being seized together with the boats or carts containing them. Coal and cedar were also important commodities from the Hunter River and occupied a number of vessels from within a year or so of the discovery of the river in 1797. The timber must have been magnificent. Isaac Nichols, a merchant at that time, advertised rich cedar for sale in 1805. It had to be cut in short lengths to get it on board these very small boats. But his samples were 2 feet wide and 6 to 8 feet long. They must have been beautiful planks, mustn't they? As early as 1799, Simeon Lord obtained permission to work coal at Hunter's River, and within a year he was dispatching cargoes to the Cape and to India on overseas vessels. Now, this was quite legitimate, and if you come to think of it, visiting vessels were desperate for return cargoes of any sort. It was the Bass Strait trade, however, that was initially the most successful. The voyages of the Martha and other small vessels to and from the islands were well within the official limits, and a cargo of oil and skins was readily sold to the master of any ship bound to China, India, or England. In March 1804, Governor King wrote a dispatch in which he stated, "The great success of individuals in procuring oil and skins from Bass Straits and the islands has been very profitable to those individuals and a great advantage to the colony in the number of men and small vessels employed. Several boats larger than originally allowed had been permitted to be built by Governor Hunter and myself, provided they did not go beyond the limits of the settlement." He added that he'd given Mr. Campbell permission to build a vessel of 130 tons, and he requested permission to extend this privilege to others. Perhaps, though, the time was even yet not quite ripe, in 1804, remember, for the building of such large vessels, large, that is, by the standards of the colony. For Campbell did not immediately take advantage of his permit, and his ship, the Perseverance, was not launched until January 1807. The publication of the Sydney Gazette in 1803 gives us our first detailed accounts of early private shipping. It's worthy of mention that from 1807 onwards, small private craft voyaged to Tahiti and the Fijis, Tonga and the Marquesas, for such things as pork for local consumption, and later on for sandalwood and bêche de mer for re-export to China. But even these ships were small. I've got a list of five of them here. The Hawkesbury, 18 tons, 4 men, on a voyage to Tahiti. The Venus schooner, 20 tons, 3 men, to the Fijis. Elizabeth cutter, 33 tons, to the Marquesas. Speedwell schooner, 15.5 tons. The Mercury schooner, 53 tons. Now, she made 10 trips to these islands in the space of 4 years. She was probably about as long as a single-decker bus, not more than 40 feet at the very most. Now, during these early years of the century, private colonial craft generally were very small. Indeed, coastal craft the world over were small at that time. There's one lovely story of a famous American clipper captain, Nathaniel B. Palmer, who about this time sailed from the Boston area in America right down to the Antarctic to go sealing, and his boat was a half-decked sailing boat, and he was away for 18 months. Anyhow, gradually a few slightly larger craft capable of long deep water passages came off the slipways. Cable & Co.'s Contest of 44 tons is a pioneer, unless this should go to the sealer Martha of 30 tons of 1799. The Contest was the vessel commenced at Underwood's Yard in 1798. She was launched at last in May 1804 as a sloop for the sealing trade, and was the largest vessel, a vessel of 38 feet, the largest vessel up to that time. In the next year, though, Cable & Co. added to their fleet a fully rigged three-mast ship of no less than 185 tons. She was probably about 80 feet long, really big one, and he sent her whaling. This vessel was called the King George. The brig Perseverance was not launched until January 1807, 136 tons. She sailed to Fiji and the Solomon Islands, and then she specialised in the sealing trade in the far colder and more tempestuous waters off Macquarie Island. Now, this is the ship, of course, that you can see the replica of this ship at Old Sydney Town at Somersby. And she's well worth close inspection and reflection that, small as she is by our standards, she was considerably larger than most of her contemporaries. And when you go on board that ship, you find that the decks and the masts and spars are, well, they are very, very well done. A friend of mine was responsible for it, and I've checked his measurements afterwards, and it's a very accurate thing. All the measurements are good. Below deck, because of thousands of visitors go through, they've had to fit her out far more luxuriously than would have been the case. So when you go on board the Perseverance at Old Sydney Town and you walk through the hold and through the cabins, for goodness sake, remember that the master's cabin probably would have been 6 foot 6 long only, and the crew's quarters would have probably been 10 feet long, because they had to have two lots of bunks in that and people down the middle as well. But it's no good. If people just saw what the Perseverance was like below deck, they wouldn't bother to go below. So she looks a bit smarter than that for, publicity reasons, I suppose. But she looks very nice below deck. Now, I don't propose to submit a catalogue of all the private vessels recorded for those early years, but there are at least 80 names. It's very difficult in any case to give a complete list, because although there's an occasional list of private colonial vessels in the official returns, we have to rely mainly on reports of ship movements as recorded in the Sydney Gazette. There are also very many vessels of short life. Coastal waters here are not the best for well-found sailing ships of reasonable size, let alone for these poor little tiddlers that we had sailing 200 years ago. Now, the number of private craft officially listed in any one year is very small. 1804, there were only 22 altogether. 1806, only 21. And even in 1813, there were still only 33 private vessels registered. and of these 33, only 7 were of 100 tons or more. Even at that late date, the majority of our ships were under 25 tons. In other words, they were hardly more than decked boats. The lists and movements reported in the Sydney Gazette do not include small harbour craft, which we can presume proliferated after 1800. But it's interesting to note that even in March 1810, at the start of Governor Macquarie's term of office, he reported there was not a single vessel in the harbour that I could dispatch to fetch Governor Bligh from Tasmania, this is, but the first boat that came from the Coal River, I immediately sent off for the Derwent to inform him of my arrival here. These craft were small, most of them hardly bigger than the modern ship's boat, and apart from the sealers, there were very few indeed that were capable of venturing even down to Van Diemen's Land. Now, I've tried to thread my way through what is really rather a wilderness of old records. Now, I have no illusion of the amount of work necessary to fill the gaps in this story. I've really only skimmed the surface of what is available as fact and what may be deduced from those facts. I should like to have been able to include some more light-hearted items, but, you know, our forefathers, best part of 200 years ago, they really were serious-minded in what they thought fit to put down for posterity in print. And apart from Collins' mention of the kangaroo figurehead of the buffalo, and what he said about the lower orders calling the Rose Hill packet by that name, the only other example I've come across of the humour of those days is from the Sydney Gazette in 1803, which said, "A boat built in the jail yard was launched on Friday. She is the property of the chief constable, and from the circumstances of her birth, which they took care to print both ways so she'd get the joke, from the circumstances of her birth has already been baptised the prisoner at large." Hearty laughter all round. And what about the group of men who were so keen on getting into the sealing game that they built their first boat without any previous experience of boat building at all, working from the Encyclopaedia Britannia? This first boat they built was wrecked in the harbour, fortunately, but their second boat, built professionally, was the Martha, that very first of the sealers. In March 1800, incidentally, the Martha went to Norfolk Island and back, and she was then sent up to Hunter's River for coal. But, by mistake, her master entered Lake Macquarie. When she left for another cargo of coal, her destination was publicly announced, not as Hunter's River or Lake Macquarie, but as Reed's Mistake. Reed was the master of the ship. And if you look at your charts, at least, I don't know about modern charts, but until fairly recently, the entrance of Lake Macquarie has been marked as Reed's Mistake. And of course, there is the unconscious humour of a society which had far more rigid social barriers than we admit to today. When a boat builder, for example, would regularly advertise that he would undertake to build boats for gentlemen and others. Now tonight I've attempted to tell you something of a very small field of nautical research. I hope you found something interesting in what I've said, and I hope also that when you next see an old painting or print of the harbour in the early days of settlement, you may be tempted to try to identify some of those little blurs of small craft that they didn't bother to paint in properly. Could that vessel possibly be the Rose Hill Packet, or that other one, the Francis? What's that vessel that looks so suspiciously like a Thames barge doing sailing up the Parramatta River in 1806? Could it be a boat built for those plans in 1804, or was it merely an English artist remembering what the Thames looked like and painting from memory? An interest in a subject such as this can also add something to a stroll through the city, to recall the look of the bridge that gave Bridge Street its name, Reby Place, to remind you of Thomas Reby, or Reby, an early shipowner. Palmer Street, Woolloomooloo, to remind us of the enterprise of Mr. Palmer, another pioneer shipbuilder and sealer. The overseas terminal, where any one of the modern cruise liners could carry the whole of any year's private colonial fleet, of that first 25 years, the whole colonial fleet could be carried on the Davis, of a cruise liner, and there would be plenty of room for all her own. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.